Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the 2016 electoral season begins to heat up, my guest today argues for an unbiased, nonpartisan way to resolve disputed elections, which whose provisions do not exist in our Constitution. He's written a history of disputed elections. Now, when we think of disputed elections, one naturally gravitates towards Bush v. Gore, where the U.S. Supreme Court intervened. But disputed elections happen nearly every cycle, and some have major effect. Think of Senator Al Franken's disputed win in Minnesota in 2008. It was held up for months. Why? Because he was to become the 60th Democratic vote in the U.S. Senate. In election law specialist Edward Foley's new book, Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States, he outlines why our founding fathers didn't make a provision for an independent way of resolving electoral disputes, and how soon after, they were equally vexed as us today. In the book, he recounts disputed elections going back to 1792 and John Jay going for the New York governorship, Lyndon Johnson's first Senate race in 1948, and of course, the Hayes-Tilden presidential race in 1876, which was even more controversial than Bush v. Gore in our days. Kennedy and Nixon could very well have been another disputed election. Interestingly, the resolution to a 1974 Oklahoma Senate race between Henry Bellman and Ed Edmondson is touted in the book as one way to resolve disputes. Edward Foley is a professor of law and director of election law at the Ohio State University School of Law, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Edward Foley, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me, Rick.
Well, as 2016 unrolls, and this is, of course, a big election year, and really only the third or fourth time in about the last 100 years where a sitting president or sitting vice president isn't going to be running for the top office, at least at this point in the season. So again, a wide open campaign for the presidency. But your book looks at all sorts of elections in which disputes have played a role. And of course, it's only been 16 years since Bush v. Gore. And what's interesting is, much like other disputed elections in our country's past, we really haven't done much to change the process of resolving a truly disputed election.
That's exactly right. I think if you look at the history, we see some flaws in the procedures that we use. And it seems like after every one of these disputes, when they're over, we go, phew, thank God we got over that. And we haven't really looked at the mechanism for how to do better the next time around. And so one of the goals of the book is to say, if you look at the sweep of history, these things happen enough that it's good to prepare for them. It's like building a ship with enough lifeboats. It's advanced planning. It's a form of risk management, if you will.
And really, even though when people think of disputed presidential elections, we think of 2000 and Bush v. Gore, really 2004, there was a lot of talk that John Kerry could have contested Ohio because of irregularities in who voted and who were counted provisionally and the like there. So given the fact that we're pretty evenly divided country, it seems like at this point we should be really thinking about a fair and nonpartisan way to resolve contested elections.
That's exactly right, Rich. And that is one important lesson from 2004, is that these things aren't flukes. They can happen with some degree of regularity. And history helps show that, because if you go back to the 1880s and 1870s, another period of polarization and intense partisanship in the country, in the political system, there was a series of elections back then that were extremely close, and 1876 was a huge mess. But then 1884, just a couple of cycles later, it took 2 weeks to resolve the election. I mean, if it took 2 weeks to resolve a presidential election now, we'd think we were back in 2000 in a Florida-type scenario. And they really had two of those right in a row. And 1880 was close, and 1888 was close. And so in the current environment, and as you say, with this year looking extremely competitive, we could have another extremely close election. Now, the good news is it takes a combination of factors. It's like a perfect storm scenario where these things spin out of control and end up being like 2000 or 1876. You know, fortunately, there can be elements in the system that kind of put a circuit breaker, if you will. I mean, one of the reasons why 1884 didn't get as messy as 1876 is that the swing state there was New York. And the New York bar, the lawyers, on a bipartisan basis said, we're going to scrutinize the state closely in a way that we are all looking over each other's shoulders. And as a result of that, at the end of 2 weeks, they said, okay, we've got a fair process. We know the result. You know, one side is always going to lose and doesn't like to lose, but they said that this was a fair election, and then they were able to move on. So there are better ways to handle these things, even in exceptionally close situations. And so, you know, if we have another one like this, we'd rather 2016 be like 1884 instead of being like 1876 or being like 2000.
Right, right. While we've been talking about presidential politics, one of the things that your book points out is that there are always disputed elections. Nearly every cycle, there is a disputed election. In fact, you begin the book with a relatively obscure story of, in 2012, the battle over Ohio's 98th state house district. Why was this so important?
Well, I do think it shows the point that the same intrinsic fights over county votes happen in all different types of elections. U.S. Senate elections, you know, Oklahoma had one of those back in 1974 where the state of Oklahoma actually handled it very well. It then went to the U.S. Senate, which made a mess of it. So it could be a governor's race, which is obviously an extremely important office for any particular state. And yet it could be the same type of fight, whether it's a so-called provisional ballot or an absentee ballot or what have you, could come up in any one of these different elections. So structurally, there are these similar features, and we can learn from that. The likelihood of the proverbial asteroid hitting in a presidential race is small, thank goodness. But there are enough of these of different types that we could learn across all the different offices. So that was kind of a point number one. The other point is that the procedure used for that local Ohio race is historically the most common procedure and the one that's most likely to lead to a sense of distrust and a sense of it being unfair and rigged, and that is when the legislature of the state itself says, okay, we're going to resolve the dispute. And the reason why that's a problem is the legislature is the most political body there is. It's designed to be political. There's a majority party and a minority party, and they're institutionalized. And so the thought that the legislature is going to look at the counting of ballots in any kind of objective or impartial way is just not realistic. And that was just a recent example that showed that. And the point of the book is to show the trajectory of how we have adjusted. We're better actually at this than we used to be. We're far from perfect, and there's room for improvement. But the long sweep of history shows more use of courts to resolve these disputes than legislatures, and that's been a big improvement. The more important the fight in the 19th century that went to the legislature, the more likely there would be violence or really terrible civil unrest associated with the election. And the more that we use judges and courts, the less likely of that.
So before we leave Ohio's 98th, let me sort of set up the situation there. Ohio was one vote away in this disputed case from one party having a veto-proof majority in the House and being able to send constitutional amendments directly to the people. And so this was why this was such a contentious issue. And in fact, because this was disputed, there was some conditions where a number of voters were sent to the wrong voting place by poll workers, in which basically the state is encouraging people to cast wrongfully counted ballots. So that was the issue at the heart. And the deciding force that was going to decide whether to create this veto-proof majority was the majority.
That's exactly right. Yes, and so the stakes are extremely high. And one lesson, I'm a law professor, and I wrote this book as a history book for the following reason. To really understand this topic, one has to look at the high-stakes disputes throughout history, because just a different beast whether or not it's a race that doesn't really matter. I mean, if it's a kind of a run-of-mill, if it's one seat in the legislature that's not going to make a difference as to which party controls the legislature, yes, the candidate and the voters of that district aren't going to care. And yes, there may be some manipulation of the process that's not so great, and we could improve that process. But it feels different to the people involved than if everything hinges on this, if political power in the state itself hinges on this. And so when the stakes get ratcheted up, it puts incredible pressure on the legal machinery that deals with this. And so the goal of the project was to figure out how can we as a society, you know, we're the United States, we're proud of our system, appropriately so, but if we're going to have a good legal system, we want it to handle the most difficult cases. We want democracy to work when every vote really matters, when the stakes are the highest. And so what is the most robust system that can handle everything, including the biggest ones? And so that's where it became apparent to me that these high-stakes races are just a different beast in terms of the character of how it affects the participants than in a run-of-the-mill election. And so I wanted to look all across the country and across the decades for patterns with regard to that situation. And so this Ohio race was of that feature in that power, real power, hinged on the outcome. And yet tied with that is the story of these there was an 8-vote difference in the official count, and it turned out there were, you know, more than 20 voters who were affected by this poll worker error. I don't think the poll workers were malicious in sending the voters to the wrong polling place. They just, poll workers are volunteers, essentially, and sometimes make mistakes. It was in a particular town in Ohio, the town was divided in quadrants, so there could be the same street address if you lived in either the northeast, southeast, northwest, or southwest part of town. And so the poll worker just read the address wrong and sent the voter to the wrong polling location because of the confusion between northeast and northwest, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, in your book, Ballot Battles, tells the history of disputed elections, which goes all the way back to, I think, the first one you recount is pre-Articles of Confederation. It was a Pennsylvania chief executive position. It was sort of not a governor, but it was sort of a council of people who served as the governor. And it was a three-way race in which the majority party was split, and so the minority candidate won. And so you go through the whole history, and there were all sorts of interesting what-ifs. For example, in 1862, during the Civil War, there were seriously questions over whether the Republicans were going to lose the Congress in 1862. And there was all sorts of machinations to make sure that didn't occur. And, you know, you think you're in the middle of the Civil War. The Democrats are associated with the South in the Civil War. They're the minority party in the North. What would have happened if, in fact, the Congress had changed in 1862?
No, that's exactly right. I'm glad you mentioned that one, as well as the ones at the very beginning of the country. You're going to that first, and then if I can come back to the Civil War afterwards. One of the reasons why we've been struggling as a nation with this problem is at our birth, it was sort of built into the system that we weren't supposed to like political parties. You know, factions were evil, the founders said, and they had hoped that they could create a system that through separation of powers would kind of divide and conquer and keep the factions kind of fluid and loose, but not developing into sort of two more or less permanent parties constantly at war with each other. Well, of course, that design didn't work. And so in these early elections, you can watch the founders struggling with this problem of kind of their own making. And so they didn't give us the right institutions, the objective, impartial institutions to handle this problem because they had hoped to avoid it another way. And again, although we've improved by using courts more than legislatures, we've still not quite got it right in terms of the best institution to handle this. So that's kind of the overall arc of the story, and it goes very much back to the founding of why this kind of missing ingredient wasn't there at the beginning, and it sort of took them by surprise, and we've never completely fixed it. But then the Civil War episode was actually a surprise to me. It was not going into this project. There were many of these episodes that I didn't know about until I started doing my research, and the 1862 election was definitely one of them. And frankly, it was more disturbing to me than maybe a lot of the other episodes, because I've grown up revering Lincoln, and I think we should for lots of reasons. And the good news is that this is an episode where a real problem was averted, thank goodness, because there's some technical rules for Congress's parliamentary procedures at the very beginning of a session of the House of Representatives. And I don't think we need to go into all the technical details, but the upshot of it is that the Republicans had won control of the House of Representatives after the 1862 election, kind of fair and square, meaning that they had enough votes to elect the Speaker of the House of their party and organize the House as Republican majority without depending upon fraud at the polls or military coercion at the polls. There had been some of that in some jurisdictions, and there had been some historians who thought that there might have been enough of that that might have given control of the House of Representatives to the Republicans. But my analysis was that, notwithstanding those real problems that shouldn't have happened, that there were enough other valid seats that had been fairly won that you could see is an example of overall democracy working, even in the midst of a terrible civil war, in terms of which party was in control of the government. So that was an upshot of the analysis. But it is true, and the record is well documented, that he had contingency plans. In other words, if the Democrats had taken control of the House of Representatives, Lincoln had the military, or a unit of the military on alert, that they might have actually gone into the House chamber to force the Republicans to be able to keep control of the chamber, and that would have been unprecedented in American history, as far as I know, and that military intervention into the internal workings of Congress, that's starts to feel like a coup d'etat.
Yes, it does.
And would have been a really terrible thing if it had happened. Now, Lincoln and his side thought that the Democrats were manipulating the process unfairly themselves, and there was a plot or conspiracy. Those may be little loaded terms, but there was an attempt by Democrats to use the power of the clerk of the House, normally just a functionary official, not an elected person, to kind of potentially manipulate who was allowed to get seated at the House. And the Republicans thought that that Democratic plot was kind of an unfair, illegitimate thing. So both sides were accusing each other of subversion of democracy. But had the military intervened to prevent the internal operations of Congress kind of handling it, that would have crossed a line that we never, had crossed before or have crossed since. But the big takeaway is, thank goodness, it wasn't tested. The Republicans were able to achieve control without hitting those tripwires.
Yeah. My guest today is Edward Foley, a professor of law and director of election law at Ohio State University School of Law. His new book is titled Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And before we talk about the ideas you have for maybe solving some of this way we resolve disputed elections, I was struck by something you were just saying. In this era, 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, in the era of Reconstruction, in the year in which voters were suppressed, mainly African-American voters, you said in a lot of cases it would be one party was denied a fair count of the ballots actually cast, and the other side was denied a fair election because so many votes were suppressed by fear and intimidation. And that gets into the heart of a lot of these disputes in the late 1800s.
Right, and the first rule of thumb that I would come up with for state governments is do as much as you can to avoid a fight over the counting of votes. Try to structure your electoral system in advance so you don't get into this mess to begin with. Again, it's a risk management. It's like emergency response. So build the levees tall enough that they don't breach, right? In other words, if you're worried about hurricanes, build stronger levees. If you worry about earthquakes, build stronger buildings. And if we do that with elections, we could reduce the likelihood of fighting over the ballots afterwards, after they've been cast. But the other historical truth is that no matter how much you try to solve this problem in advance, there's always something that you didn't think of, a new way to try to game the system or a new problem that emerges. So again, even if you think you built the levees high enough, there will be that storm that might breach them, or they might crack. Again, they thought the Titanic was an unsinkable ship and didn't put enough lifeboats, but it wasn't, and they needed those lifeboats afterwards. And so the second part of running fair elections is having good counting mechanisms as well as the good mechanisms for casting the ballots in the first place. But you need both. And so it is important that when there's been a big election and something emerges so that there's a genuine dispute over the counting of votes, you need that process to be fair, even if something went awry in the casting of ballots to begin with. But when the stakes are this high, one side will say, well, because of the unfairness in the casting of votes, we think we can manipulate the count. And we think we can blatantly ignore the rules for counting votes because you mistreated us in the casting of them. Well, that gets into this basic ethical question. Do two wrongs make a right, or no? Is it important to follow fair rules for counting ballots when you're in that counting situation? And one can have different judgments about that. My own sense is that the integrity of the process requires a fair count, even if the casting didn't go well. But there's no rule book. I mean, again, the founders didn't give us answers to these questions. We can't go back and ask James Madison, how do we solve this ourselves? Because it turns out that Madison and Hamilton and our founders, when they encountered these disputes, they didn't really know what to do either.
Yeah, that becomes clear in the book, is that they really didn't have a clear clue on how to resolve it, a truly disputed election. In your book, you do offer some solutions, a reform to remedy this. And so since there are no precedents from the founders, should we be looking to countries that do have unbiased, nonpartisan ways to resolve contested elections? How is the best way to create a system in which we do this in the most nonpartisan way possible?
Well, it is true that many countries that have sort of inherited our so-called British common law system of laws and jurisprudence have developed these nonpartisan institutions. And that, frankly, is one reason why I started with that local Ohio race and then went back to history, because Britain early on in its parliamentary elections realized it just was not fair to have the majority party in the House of Commons deciding disputes over seats in the House of Commons, and that's because it would be rigged from the beginning. And so even before, but basically just a couple of years before we separated from England in 1776, they said we need a nonpartisan procedure. But that didn't cross the Atlantic in time, and so we didn't adopt it. It was the so-called Grenville Act, after a minister of England who was actually despised in the colonies. So maybe that's why we didn't adopt it. But so England and Britain and Australia and Canada, other countries like that, have been inherited based on this Grenville tradition of insulating the dispute tribunal that counts the votes from partisan politics. And so they have done a better job on the whole. But in fairness to us, you know, their system is also a bit different. Because they're parliamentary systems with prime ministers, they don't have elected chief executives the way we do. Either you know, we have president and governors. And one of the points in the book is that the stakes are much higher with chief executive elections. The legislative elections that are high is when it's control of the chamber, like we talked about before. But the run-of-the-mill legislative election is a lower-stakes phenomenon. So the nonpartisan institutions in those other so-called common-law countries aren't quite as tested to the same degree as our most demanding circumstances. So we kind of have to invent our own procedure for our own system. It wasn't given to us by the founders, and it isn't given to us from looking overseas completely. I mean, we can look at some other countries. France has an elected president, but they've never been tested quite the way we were in Bush versus Gore back in 1876. Mexico had an interesting election in 2006, but not exactly clear that their system would work for us, et cetera. So we really have to kind of look at our own values, our own institutions, and say what makes sense for us. And there are some good examples. In fact, there was one, again, this 1974 U.S. Senate election in Oklahoma. The judge in Oklahoma that got assigned the case was, as a result of a procedure used in the state, was they told both candidates and both parties, you've got to agree on the trial judge for this case so that you can't claim that the adjudicator is biased. Well, some form of that bilateralism, if you will, where both parties feel like the tribunal is equally acceptable to both sides, that I think is the best that we can humanly do. It's difficult because political parties are suspicious of everybody. How do we know that the judge isn't, you know, one of them instead of one of us? But this Oklahoma example, there are examples from Minnesota, there's examples from around the country at different stages where both sides have said, look, we can pick a judge or a three-judge panel that is fairly representative of both sides and even-handed. And when that has been done, that tends to legitimate the process more than anything else.
So an arbitration.
Exactly right. They don't usually use that term, although Claiborne Pell, a U.S. senator from Rhode Island, actually used that term as a proposal that wasn't adopted, but he wanted a New Hampshire election to be adjudicated by an arbiter, and he wanted to go to the American Arbitration Association for insight about how to use an arbiter. So I think that's exactly right. Some notion of arbitration, it has to be binding, and it has to be set up in advance, or it's better if it's set up in advance. Well, Minnesota has this example, which was sort of surprising, in 1962, where a governor's election was kind of dumped into their laps, and they were still able to say, okay, we're going to have a three-judge panel, and they picked one judge who was seen as representative of each party, and then they had another judge who had been appointed at one level of the judiciary by the governor of one party and another level by another party, and they said, hey, this person is kind of representative of both sides, and both candidates said, yeah, that person is an acceptable neutral arbiter. So it can be done. And when that happens, again, the lesson of history is the outcomes are more successful in terms of the sense of stability, a sense of closure, a sense of doing the best you can under the circumstances.
The name of the book is Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. One last quick question, and that is, in Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court said that decision only accounted for that single election. If we had another disputed presidential election, do you think the Supreme Court would intervene again?
Well, that is the big $64 zillion question, and one of the reasons why Congress would be advised, the country would be advised to kind of look at our procedures now, and when there's still enough time, because we don't know what would happen. The Supreme Court's jurisdiction is discretionary. They could say, we were burned the last time. It was a 5-4 decision. It was thought to be ugly. We're not coming close to touching that. And if that's true, then the dispute would go to Congress and not the court. And again, it would be the legislature, and it would be a kind of a mess. On the other hand, precisely because it would be a mess if the dispute went to Congress, the court could say, well, as ugly as the Florida 2000 was, it still was better that the court intervened. So we just don't know. And that unpredictability is not good. All election lawyers will say, if you can, you want to know what will happen ahead of time, because you can't game the system if the rules are clear in advance. And yet our rules aren't clear in this one important respect. We don't know whether the Supreme Court would intervene or not.
Professor Foley, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Rich. I really appreciate it.
Edward Foley is the Director of Election Law and a Professor of Law at The Ohio State University School of Law. His book is titled Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. It's published by Oxford University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.